Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, a look at the issues that affect the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. We will examine why so many adults who may have witnessed the abuse failed to report it. Plus, the story of a North Valley doctor who serves the new homeless. And the Fresno Historic Scavenger Hunt, what it takes to join in. But first, the city of Merced was hit hard by the economic crash and foreclosure crisis in the past decade. In an already poor and medically underserved region, the recession created a new group of homeless people who have very limited access to medical care. But one determined doctor, aided by Golden Valley Health Center staff and student volunteers from UC Merced, is striving to ensure these people don't fall through the cracks. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin reports from Merced.
Below a Highway 99 overpass and sandwiched between the D Street homeless shelter and the railroad tracks is an unlikely beacon of hope for Merced residents low on luck. It's an RV that houses Golden Valley Health Center's mobile health clinic for the homeless.
How are you doing?
Okay, I'm in a little pain still. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, not a little pain, a lot of pain.
55-year-old Nick Arellano has come to the mobile unit to see Dr. Salvador Sandoval, the homeless clinic's doctor. Arellano has long hair and blue eyes that shine from his weathered face.
As you know, the change of weather with my legs, mm-hmm. it increases a lot the pain. Mm-hmm. And right out of my sleeping pills also.
He's looking for relief from the chronic pain stemming from a construction accident. He's also looking for help kicking a heroin habit that's haunted him for more than 40 years.
Had you ever been on a methadone program for the heroin?
Yes, I was on for 2 years. Mm-hmm. It seems like my body doesn't accept it.
The heroin or the methadone?
No, the heroin is fine.
The doctor leans against the wall and looks directly into Arellano's eyes as he asks the patient about his health and living conditions.
I haven't done it in a while.
When's the last time?
God, I say good 5 weeks, a little longer than that.
Dr. Sandoval will see Arellano and about 8 to 12 more patients during the weekly half-day clinic. It costs about $3,000 to $4,000 a month to operate. It receives no grants and is funded solely through employee contributions and community donations. But what the mobile clinic may lack in resources, it makes up in heart. The passion starts at the top with Sandoval.
I think ultimately we need a healthcare system that's fair and that's available to everyone as a right.
Sandoval's been practicing medicine in Merced for about 35 years. He's an old school type of physician who makes house calls to the elderly and makes an effort to connect with each of his patients. He says he's always been driven by a mission to help the underserved, especially the homeless.
Some of them have drug problems, some have mental illness. But I think those things need to be addressed societally, and they're human.
He's seen the ranks of the homeless swell during the economic crash. That's created an even greater need for the health clinic. It takes patients on a first-come, first-served basis, and is almost always booked to capacity.
Lately, I've been seeing people that never thought they were going to be homeless. I mean, like a nurse that was an OB nurse, a guy that was doing public relations for a major company, public relations person for the city, a person that was doing was a psych tech, another one that was an instructor at the college. People that were truck drivers, construction. So people that probably, if you talk to them 5 or 10 years ago, they would have said, no, I would never be homeless.
If anyone's familiar with the homeless population's need for medical care, it's Sandoval. He's been caring for the homeless off and on for about 15 years. Before the doctor began offering care to the homeless through the mobile unit, he did it from the trunk of his car, using medicine samples donated by other local doctors.
I kept all my equipment and supplies in there, and then I would take them into the National Guard Armory during the winter.
Golden Valley launched the mobile clinic about 5 years ago. Today, it's one of the few places where the homeless can see a doctor and receive medications at no cost. Patients can also get free dental extractions and vision exams through the Golden Valley Network. Take it from 38-year-old Zane Howard. He lives in a tent in a homeless encampment. He was at the clinic last Tuesday to get the results of some blood work.
I think there's a big misconception that just because you're homeless, you qualify for the medical assistance program. And let me assure you that that's not the case at all.
He turned around and pulled up his brown shirt.
I was actually stabbed in the back. Let me show you.
Yes.
And it's a 2-foot knife wound. And I went to the health department. They told me that I wasn't in the hospital long enough, so I didn't qualify.
Beyond that, he comes to the clinic to see Dr. Sandoval.
Dr. Sandoval is absolutely amazing. He's a very thoughtful, compassionate person, and he has just listened to everything I've had to say.
Dr. Sandoval's work at the mobile clinic is supported by a receptionist, a medical assistant, and 8 student volunteers from UC Merced. He hopes it evolves into a student-run clinic where undergraduate and medical students can gain on-the-ground healthcare experience. Already, many of the students, like the patients, say Dr. Sandoval is a major draw for them.
I think he's a very well-rounded community physician. He's very compassionate. He's very down-to-earth. I just can't describe it. Yeah. He's just a very humble, caring man.
That's Isidro Ramirez, a UC Merced graduate who's been volunteering at the clinic for about 2 years. He's inspired by Dr. Sandoval's dedication to the homeless.
It's been a life-changing in the sense that it paints a bigger picture of just how medically underserved communities such as this are. Working with the homeless gives a whole dimension to working with those most in need.
Inside the clinic, Dr. Sandoval is finishing up his visit with Nick Arellano, who winces as the doctor gives him a cortisone shot in the arm.
That means I'm going to be able to sleep tonight?
Hopefully.
Oh, my God. God is good. God is good.
He also prescribes Arellano medication for his chronic pain.
Okay. Why don't you go up front, and they'll make a copy of this for you right now while I make the prescription out. Okay.
I wish I knew you better a long time ago. After all, my body won't be so destroyed as it is.
With the help of Dr. Sandoval and the homeless clinic, Arellano now has a fighting chance. Reporting in Merced, I'm Rebecca Plevin with Valley Public Radio.
For the past few decades, journalists and activists have gone undercover in order to document cases of animal abuse at slaughterhouses and dairies across the nation. That's led the livestock industry to push for legislation in several states that would make producing those videos a crime. In California, one Valley lawmaker is pushing for a different approach, but not without controversy. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero has this report.
At this point, we've all likely seen or at least heard about cases of widespread animal cruelty or neglect when it comes to cattle, chickens, and horses across the Central Valley.
Tens of thousands of cows each year wind up at Central Valley Meat, a slaughter plant in California. A Compassion Over Killing investigator documented the final hours of pain and fear these cows face before they're slaughtered and their bodies are dismembered.
That was an excerpt from an undercover video produced by the organization Compassion Over Killing. Its depiction of cattle being repeatedly abused and treated inhumanely made national headlines last August. It also caused the United States Department of Agriculture to temporarily close down the Hanford slaughterhouse. Other animal welfare groups and news organizations have produced similar videos, but with them has come controversy and criticism from the livestock industry. And that's led several states, including Iowa and Utah, to pass new laws, which aim to make producing those videos a crime. Critics call them ag gag laws. In California, the issue of animal abuse has taken a slightly different course, but one that's no less controversial, thanks to a new bill from Assemblymember Jim Patterson.
I think we all detest animal cruelty. I think we want to stop it as quickly as we possibly can. And I think there is a duty on behalf of the people who own animals and on the behalf of people who work with them if they do see and have the evidence of animal cruelty, that it ought to be reported to law enforcement quickly so that the cruelty can end.
The Fresno Republican introduced AB 343 in early February. Unlike the measures in other states, it doesn't prohibit journalists or activists from taking undercover video, but instead it would require anyone with video, photographs, or other evidence documenting animal abuse to turn in that information to authorities within 5 days. Those who don't comply would face a $250 fine. The bill is supported by the livestock industry. Patterson says he doesn't understand why animal rights groups aren't in favor of the bill.
I mean, my question is, do they really want to solve the problem, or are they more interested in fundraising and stirring up people who love animals and really misinforming people about what we're trying to do? But let me just say this. If people were saying the same thing about child abuse that they're saying about my bill to try and end animal abuse, no one would support or understand it or be willing to suggest that we turn a blind eye to it and that we collect data for months into the future.
But some animal welfare groups, including the Humane Society of the United States, say the bill is an attempt to stymie larger investigations.
There's a reason all of the animal protection groups oppose this bill, while only agribusiness industry officials support it. It may be drafted to appear like an animal protection measure. In reality, it's intended to obstruct whistleblowers from documenting farm animal abuse. They don't want to stop whistleblowing. They want to blow the whistle on the whistleblower.
That was Paul Shapiro, a spokesman for the Humane Society. If AB 343 had been law last year, Shapiro says Central Valley Meat Company would still be treating cattle inhumanely.
If this law had been in place, the meat industry would have surely just described it as an isolated incident of animal cruelty rather than the pattern of abuse that was taking place there, which led to the shutdown of that slaughter plant.
But Dave Daly, with the California Cattle Association, which sponsored the bill, says it's misunderstood.
I think AB 343, very honestly, is intended. It was proposed by cattlemen because we don't like to see animals abused either. And some of the things that occur, if people willfully or knowingly record abuse, I think the real intent is let's get that information to law enforcement as soon as we can so we can stop it. It bothers me that it's been posed as an ag gag law or trying to stop free speech or trying to stop, you know, people from taking pictures. And in my mind, it's nothing further from the truth, because in all actuality, it's trying to prevent systemic abuse rather than to just let it go on for a period of time until, quote unquote, we have a case.
Amendments to the bill were made late last week after criticism over the time allotted for gathering and reporting evidence. Patterson said the changes were his attempt to work with animal welfare groups.
Initially, we had a couple of days requirement to report. There's some concern that that might be too short a period of time. And so we were trying to be sympathetic with those who have a different point of view about the bill. We thought, okay, well, let's amend it to 5 days. That gives people who want to do more investigating or more documentation. But at some point, we've got to end the documentation so that we can give it to law enforcement and the animal owners so they're on notice so that, in fact, the abuse stops.
Jim Reynolds, a professor of bovine medicine and animal welfare at Western University, says the bill doesn't go far enough.
The idea is really good. See it, stop it. So I think that's what the authors of the bill probably intend, is if you see something that's harming an animal, then it needs to be stopped and fixed and dealt with. Limiting it strictly to videotaping or photographs is the wrong approach. Really, if any event that harms an animal needs to be reported and fixed for the animal's sake and for the animals down the road the next week and the next week.
He says the industry needs to embrace animal welfare to prevent future abuses.
What many of us have been trying to do for about a year now is to create a culture of welfare on farms so that everybody on the farm, the owners, the managers, the workers, all understand what animal welfare is and can recognize when welfare is compromised for animals and then do something about it.
Patterson's bill is scheduled to go before the Assembly's Agriculture Committee on Wednesday. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
California faces sanctions, fines, and possible jail time for Governor Jerry Brown if the state continues to defy a federal court order to reduce its prison population. That harsh ruling from a three-judge panel came last week in response to the governor's motion to vacate a prison population cap those judges imposed 7 years ago when they found that overcrowding was the main reason inmates suffered and died from a lack of health care. Now they say overcrowding is still a problem. KPCC's Julie Small looks at what options are left for Governor Brown and the state.
In 2006, a panel of federal judges ordered California to reduce the number of inmates in the prisons by 40,000. Then Attorney General Jerry Brown fought the decision all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But in 2011, the justices upheld the order to bring down the state's prison population. As governor, Jerry Brown pushed through realignment, the law that hands responsibility for thousands of felons to the counties. That was supposed to bring down the population far enough, but when it became clear last year that the state would fall short of the mark by 9,000 inmates, Governor Brown refused to do more, and he refused in a very public way.
The governor put himself in the center of this dispute by holding a press conference in January in which he announced that this was going to be the state's policy.
Don Spector, an attorney with the Prison Law Office, says Brown has been thumbing his nose at the federal court for a year. Spector says the judges made the right call by threatening the governor with a contempt of court charge.
And so they've given him one last final chance to act like a responsible adult and a responsible politician and follow the orders of the court. And if he doesn't, you know, we will ask the court to throw the book at him.
We are appealing this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Jeffrey Callison with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says California has spent more than $1 billion to improve prison health care. He says it's the best care in any prison system in the country. Callison says corrections officials are hoping the Supreme Court will set aside the order to cut loose inmates, and if it doesn't...
The remaining prison population is much more heavily comprised now of more serious offenders. So to further reduce that population in the next few months would involve a variety of possible measures, all of which would result in more serious offenders going into the community earlier than they would have done otherwise.
Fontana's police chief Rodney Jones says that keeps him up at night.
The scariest thing for me as a police chief is the prison overcrowding, because we're talking about 9,000 people that they missed the mark by. And between now and December, they've got to find new homes for.
Chief Jones says the jails in San Bernardino County are already full. For every felon they take in, someone else gets let out. Jones says since realignment took effect, the crime rate in Fontana has jumped by 13%.
The state may have hit the wall on that score.
Law professor Robert Weisberg with the Stanford Criminal Justice Center doubts California can expand realignment without increasing the risk. He sees a better way.
California has some very, very long-term, very, very elderly and sometimes frail life prisoners. The governor has expressed some interest in re-examining the criteria by which lifers get a chance for parole release.
Weisberg says lifers did terrible things, but he says they have very low recidivism rates, especially lifers over 50. But letting more of them get paroled won't shave 9,000 inmates from the system by December. Weisberg says the best bet for California would be to work out deals to house state prisoners in county jails that have room. He says corrections could also add to the pool of 8,000 inmates now serving terms in private prisons in other states. The federal judges gave state officials 21 days to come up with a plan. They also want to see the state work up a system to identify inmates who pose little risk and could be candidates for early release. As for the governor's response, it came during his trade mission in China. He says he'll refuse to follow the court's order. I'm Julie Small.
Starting next year, millions of people will gain new health coverage under the federal health law. In California, dozens of clinics are gearing up for the expansion, with new funding to build clinics and expand old ones. But as Pauline Bartolona reports, it may be a challenge to find the physicians to staff the new centers.
Dr. Glenn Villanueva has known he wanted to be a doctor since he was 5 years old.
I looked forward to going to the doctor. I liked how clean the office was. I liked the lab coat. It just impressed me that it was a place where people got help when they were hurting.
Now at 46 years old, Dr. Villanueva sees up to 36 patients a day at a clinic in a rural area outside of Modesto.
How are you doing today, Jose?
I'm actually not too good.
His patients are poor. Many have chronic diseases, mental health problems, or addictions. But Dr. Villanueva knew he wanted to serve the underserved.
Being Filipino myself and being an immigrant myself, it seemed kind of a natural fit. So there's something to be said from a social justice standpoint to help take care of the folks that need the most amount of help.
California has a shortage of primary care doctors in many inner cities and rural areas. Dr. Villanueva knows that from experience.
We have been attempting to recruit physicians for the last 2.5 years, and we've been unsuccessful and have made at least 7 physician offers. And we've been unsuccessful with all 7 of them. And of the 7, 5 have stated our compensation is too low for the work that we do relative to what they can make elsewhere.
The state of California tries to offset economic or other drawbacks of working in an underserved area by helping primary care doctors repay their loans. Every year, around 50 family doctors have part of their medical school debt paid off this way. Doctors get the financial benefit for a maximum of 6 years.
We find that even 15 years after an individual has received a loan repayment, more than 50% of our practitioners still remain in those areas.
Lupe Alonso Diaz with the California Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development is talking about one of 2 state loan repayment programs for family doctors. She says they have made it possible to recruit top medical students to take jobs in underserved areas. And the program tends to attract people who come from diverse backgrounds.
It's the concept of growing your own. It's this idea that individuals that are coming from, for example, from a rural agrarian area, are likely to understand what that population looks like in the same way that an individual that's coming from an inner city urban area understands that community and is more likely to be better at serving that community.
Callie Langton with the California Academy of Family Physicians says some doctors would not make the choice without the loan repayment.
I think there are a number of people that are on the fence, and that the loan repayment programs as well as other incentives can help push people over the fence.
But Langton would like to see more family doctors benefit from loan repayment, and that alone wouldn't solve the problem. She says there are many reasons for the shortage of family doctors. Specialists make more money. Medical schools don't encourage general practice, and a cap on residencies has created a bottleneck. So Langton says creating more primary care will take a multifaceted approach.
Procedures are much more highly valued than counseling. Talking to somebody about their diabetes problem is much less profitable than a similar procedure down the road. And so until our reimbursement strategies focus on providing preventative care, we really are not going to have enough people to provide those services.
Dr. Villanueva benefits from one of the state loan repayment programs and says it provides huge relief. But that's not why he practices outside Modesto.
Loan repayment program will never help the graduating physician that wants to live on the coast. Will never help the one that wants to be in the big city. Okay, it won't ever affect that demographic of physician.
His patient load is full right now, and they're still looking for 2 physicians. Next year, the patients with insurance cards under the new federal health law may be more than his clinic can handle. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and today we're going to talk about a topic that may be uncomfortable for some, child sexual abuse. It is estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually molested before they are 18. That's 20% of the population. And these are only estimates because statistics also show that somewhere between 2/3 of victims never report it. What we want to talk about today is why so many adults who may witness the crime don't report it.
Joining me is Esther Franco, Executive Director of the Fresno Council of Child Abuse Prevention. Thanks, Esther, for coming in this morning.
You're welcome.
Now, we understand why children don't report it. What are some of the factors that go into why a child may not say anything and they have a hard time, you know, telling someone, their parents or someone else, about the fact that they are being abused?
Well, first of all, specific to sexual abuse, it's very difficult for children to disclose that because it's even difficult for adults. And a lot of times children are confused because they don't know they've been molested sometimes, the way that the perpetrator grooms the child. And because 90% of all abuse, whether it's physical, emotional neglect, or sexual abuse, it's by someone the child knows. So they're telling on someone that they know, love, or trust. And that's difficult for a child's mind to grasp, even an adult's mind.
Well, you know, we think, and I think for many of us, because the Jerry Sandusky case is still fresh in a lot of people's mind. And a lot of people were shocked by that, not just by the level of crimes, but because apparently so many people knew or had witnessed him molesting children, but they didn't report it. They didn't come forward. And I know some people might argue that, well, it's because of the fact that it was Penn State and a high-level institution and the people involved, but that is not necessarily always the case of why adults or people who may even witnesses don't come forward. Adults don't come forward and tell someone about what they saw.
Well, a lot of reasons why they don't is, well, first of all, pedophiles or child molesters, whatever you want to call them, perpetrators, they're very manipulative, and they have to manipulate the adult in order to get to have access to the child. And what they do is they gain trust of the child's parent or who's ever supervising the child at that time. And that's why pedophiles do seek institutions that have great recognition. Well, for example, the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, Penn State, they seek that, and they kind of wolf in a sheep's clothing sort of strategy. But they're extremely manipulative, and they do manipulate the adults a lot of times to trust them. And sometimes I read a book by an expert on this. It's called The Socially Skilled Child Molester. And when adults do confront the perpetrator acts like so just disgusted, like, oh, my God, I would never do anything like that. How could you accuse me? And then they get the parent or caregiver to feel guilty because it is such a disgusting thing to do to a child, to any human being, to sexually molest a child. You steal their innocence and you do a lot of trauma and psychological damage.
Also, when you look at a situation like this, those people, when we talk about mandated reporters like, you know, teachers or other people, a lot of those folks were mandated reporters. They are mandated by law to report such incidents if they witness it or suspect it.
Yes, they are. And there are glitches in our system, in our legal system, to protect children. And that's one of the services that FCAP does provide, in that we try to get adults to organize and coordinate and advocate on children's behalf. The law states that if you work with children or have access to children, then you must report any signs. You must report child abuse. But if you don't know the signs or symptoms of child abuse, you don't know what to report. But the law does not give training, appropriate training. And so that's where we try and fill in the gap of the community. We provide thousands of trainings to mandated reporters. We call schools. We call there's 44 classifications right now. And we call employers and say, have you done a training? We'll provide it for free for a small donation. So learning the signs and symptoms of child abuse is very important. And especially sexual abuse, because it's very different.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I read about why some adults may not report it, is because they sort of question themselves and say, well, did I really see what I thought I saw, you know, and different things like that. Or they might think that it's, you know, none of their business.
or that they're really not qualified to know what is abuse. I would assume those are some of the things you try to work with adults with and get them to understand.
Yes, absolutely. You know, child sexual abuse it's in the papers every day. So for adults or our society to turn a blind eye to it, after especially all the huge cases, the Catholic Church, like I said, the Boy Scouts, Penn State, it happens. And people know it happens, but I think adults don't know how to deal with it because they're uncomfortable with it. But we have to get rid of that discomfort and get ourselves educated and trained and advocate for harsher penalties, but more importantly, clean up some of the gaps in our system.
Because when you think about that, when you talk about the fact that we don't report it and the fact that it's in the news every day, we've had a number of high-profile cases even here locally.
Yes, we have.
You know, in some of the schools. But by not reporting it, when you think about it, it is what, in a way, you're sort of allowing this to continue with children, many who can't, you know, speak for themselves or too ashamed to speak for themselves. And, you know, how is it that, like you said, it happens all the time, but we're still so uncomfortable with talking about it?
Well, like I said, 90% of abuse happens by someone the child knows, loves, and trusts. A lot of times it's mom's boyfriend, so mom is in denial about it, or it could be an uncle, and no one wants to report it because they don't. No one wants to confront them because they're uncomfortable about it, or they go into denial, like, I don't think I saw him, the little girl in the lap, or whatever the situation was. And it's difficult to talk about. No one who wants to talk about that.
What are some of the consequences of not reporting abuse?
The consequences of sexual abuse are a direct source of a number of other societal problems. Teen pregnancy, more than 60% of pregnant teens have been sexually abused. Substance abuse, 70 to 80% of sexual abuse survivors report excessive drug and alcohol use. Suicide, especially among male survivors, because females, girls are more likely to report than boys. 50% have suicidal thoughts and more than 20% attempt suicide. Eating disorders, sometimes they become sexual abusers themselves. 40% of adult sexual offenders report having been sexually abused as children. So the ramifications to our society for sexual abuse or any type of child abuse, the statistics are there.
You really see that, though, in what's happened to so many children and the how it sort of manifests itself when they get older. And talking about some of the situations you just mentioned, what can be done to help educate adults so not only will they be able to understand exactly what is child sexual abuse and how to identify it, what are some of the things that can be done there when it comes to training and education?
Well, the best method is to educate the parent and educate the child. We offer, it's called Stewards of Children. We offer, and it's specific, that program is specific to sexual abuse. But also, a children, there's six protective factors that parents, that are evidence-based that parents need to know. It's, first of all, nurturing and attachment with your child when your child is born, and what that involves through their ages and their stages of development, and then knowledge of parenting and child development. No parent can be an expert, but there are things that you can learn that are very basic and very important in a child's development. Parental resilience, social connections, concrete supports for parents, and social and emotional competence of your children. Parents model for their children. Now, if 75% of all child abuse, substance abuse is involved in that, you're modeling for your children. If you're getting high every day after work, if you're not acting in a responsible manner, that child is going to learn that from you. Or if you abuse your child, and the cycle continues. It's domestic violence. It's family violence. Family violence and domestic violence is child abuse. It's all very interconnected in a chaotic process that are the social dynamics of a lot of families in our society. And poverty is a huge indicator. It's a huge factor. What kind of success have you had when it comes to trying to educate adults? When you say educate the parents as well as the child?
Well, we've been doing practicing the Stewards of Children for about a couple of years, and it's difficult to get parents to sign up. It's a 2-hour training. It's a minimum 2-hour training. So we find that we have to have them go through a modified version of the mandated reporter training, because you need to learn the 4 types of abuse and then the 5 primary causes before we can go specifically into sexual abuse, because you need to learn that foundation of just child maltreatment, you know, in a society, how it happens and how it sustains itself. And then the next step is we give them the 2-hour training for Stewards of Children.
What about mandated reporters? Do you offer the same kind of program for them as well?
Yes, we encourage them. After we give a mandated reporter training and they give a certificate, we encourage them to sign up for Stewards of Children. It's a 2-hour training.
What do you think makes the program that you have adopted now, because you told me it's relatively new, mm-hmm. What makes that program effective and a good program?
Well, it's evidence-based. Our council we do not implement or promote programs unless they're evidence-based. And this is proven to be, it's award-winning and evidence-based, as is our child program, which is talking about touching. That's also evidence-based and award-winning.
So a organization or a school, can they contact you and say, okay, we want this sort of training, and then you provide it? Is that how it works?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I just hired a new educator about 6 months ago, and we're seeking more funding to hire educators to go out and get this topic on the table and talk about how we can protect our children.
Because it would seem, especially in our community, we've had just so many incidents that it would seem that it's really important to get the education out there.
It is. Knowledge is power in any industry, and especially when you're protecting your children. The developmental stages of a child, it's very important to get parenting, just basic parenting knowledge. So FCAP, we target the highest risk groups for abuse, which is teen parents, substance abuse, and then, of course, sexual predators are a factor. So that's why we're building a child advocacy center that is going to bring a team together that is not only the prevention, we're prevention education focused, but also intervention. Our mission is to coordinate community efforts to prevent and respond to child abuse. We're mandated by the state, and we're sanctioned through the Board of Supervisors through Fresno County. And it's a huge task. Throughout the Central Valley. I mean, Fresno County is the largest county, and we have a 32% poverty rate. Now, poverty is the number one indicator of, it's not the cause. People don't abuse their children just because they're poor, but they don't have resilience and they don't have supportive services.
What are, before we get close to wrapping this up, what are some of the signs and symptoms people can look for when it comes to whether or not a child may be being abused?
Well, for sexual abuse, if a child's behavior changes, a lot of times if they're wetting the bed is one, eating disorders, they're not hungry, maybe throwing tantrums. If they show fear towards a specific person or a specific activity, like, you know, going to the park, if something happened at the park or maybe a relative's house. Just any changes in their typical behavior, crying, very clingy, you know, to the parent, or fear of a particular adult is a number one indicator of that, if the perpetrator is within the family. But a lot of times, you know, some pedophiles can molest hundreds of children in their lifetime if they're not caught, because the child doesn't know that they're being sexually molested. We interviewed one girl who was being molested over 5 years' time, and it was the stepfather. So it's very difficult for children to disclose sexual abuse, because the sexual offender is their friend or relative and tells them that they love them.
How can the public help?
Education. Education is the key. Learning what's going on in your community, volunteering. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. We try and do as many community service booths as we can. Blue Sunday is coming up. For those of you who are active in your churches, the last Sunday in April is Blue Sunday. And all we ask is we're trying to incorporate just the topic of child abuse into the religious community. And all we ask is that the pastor at that last Sunday, at that service, designate and make, however he or she wants to do that, a prayer for children who are being abused.
Okay. Thank you, Esther Franco, for coming in to talk about this important topic.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Later this year, when students return to the classroom after summer break, they'll be greeted by a new curriculum that aims to replace the goals of No Child Left Behind. On this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Kay Bonner Cummings says this presents a great opportunity to put the arts back in education.
Over many decades, various research studies have shown the value and effectiveness of arts education in the lives of schoolchildren, as well as its correlation to their achievement. And yet, increasingly during the same period, educational decision makers have all but removed art education from the curriculum of most elementary schools. Why? It makes no sense. This is what we know about why arts education matters. First, being a hands-on activity, arts increase student engagement, focus on positive achievements, and keep kids in school. Second, the arts, including painting, singing in a chorus, dancing, and acting, require positive behaviors and attitudes, such as patience, persistence, and collaboration, thereby building character. Third, the arts enhance creativity, a requirement of the 21st century workforce and rapidly changing world. An example is the beautifully designed products of the Apple Corporation. Fourth, critical thinking skills are also sought-after qualities in today's world, and the arts foster these higher levels of thinking. For instance, how does one observe a painting, interpret a piece of music, analyze a play? Fifth, the arts develop various language skills, such as learning to read musical notes for singing, composing, or playing an instrument, memorizing dance steps, creating a painting, or acting in a play. Sixth, the arts provide a fun way to learn math principles, such as creating a work of art using measuring tools. Seventh, the arts can be used to teach about historical periods or make literature come alive. In one community, Shakespeare plays are used to teach anti-bullying lessons. There are many other rewards to be found in the arts, qualities such as beauty, joy, grace, emotion, empathy, as well as life lessons such as teamwork and developing a passion for learning. And finally, a multitude of studies have shown that the arts in the curriculum almost always improve test scores. Therefore, reducing or eliminating the arts in education reduces the likelihood of student success and societal satisfaction. Fortunately, times are changing. The new national curriculum, the Common Core State Standards, which include arts education as an essential component, is replacing No Child Left Behind. In addition, the teaching of the sciences is to be enhanced in a program known as STEM, or Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. In an article in Education Leadership, Robert and Michelle Root Bernstein proposed finding ways to foster the arts education alongside science education, and even better, finding ways to integrate the two. The purpose of this coupling is to produce students capable of creative participation in a science-dominated society like ours. As Max Planck, a Nobel Prize winner and accomplished pianist, said, "The creative scientist needs an artistic imagination. Indeed, so do our children need and deserve this artistic imagination. Finally, and so importantly, arts education will foster new audiences for the arts, which is critical to keeping alive the symphony orchestras, museums, theaters, operas, and dance productions so necessary to the life and health of our communities and our nation. For The Moral Is, this is Kay Cummings.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, there is nothing like a good scavenger hunt, and the Humanics program at Fresno State is hosting one coming up in May. Here to tell us more about it is Dr. Don Simmons, Distinguished Lecturer of Humanics at Fresno State, and Barbara Bochum, also with the Humanics Department. Now, this scavenger hunt is a little different from what we might be thinking about. It's a part of National Historic Preservation Week. So tell me about what people are going to be looking for or looking at.
Great. Yes. We are focusing this scavenger hunt in downtown Fresno to focus on downtown Fresno's history. Our theme for National Historic Preservation Week is see it, save it, celebrate it. We're going to help folks to see some of the historic sites and as well as some of the historic art that's in downtown Fresno. And so people will have clues, and they can use their smartphones or other devices to figure out the clues and then go there, take a photo on their phone or other device, and bring it back. And our judges, who are also members of the Historic Preservation Commission, will look and say, yes, you've got those all. So they're going to be looking for some things like statues that commemorate historic events, pieces of art that are specific to certain ethnic neighborhoods and folks of ethnic backgrounds. They're looking for first grocery stores in certain communities. They're looking for some of the things that just make Fresno so unique that we can celebrate.
You're really making this fun.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. We did this once before with our Humanics students, and we actually had some kids, some siblings, and some children of our students and staff participate with us. Kids love this. They get involved.
And it's a great history lesson, too, about downtown Fresno.
About downtown Fresno, but about Fresno as a whole. There are so many things that people don't know about Fresno. We thought of calling it, So You Think You Know Fresno. But it really is just celebrating what we have downtown.
Now, tell me a little bit about how this is going to work. It looks like you're broken up and you'll be part of a team.
Right. Well, there's going to be individual hunters or team hunters, which a team of 3 to 6 people that will participate. So there will be prizes for individual hunters as well as teams. We have the Fresno Grizzlies who've donated some tickets, some other great prizes, as well as Moravia Winery who's donated a case of wine. We have several little shops down in downtown Fresno that have donated gift baskets. So we have some really great prizes, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
What really went into kind of selecting the sites?
Well, as being a part of the Historic Preservation Commission, it was a natural list for us. We wanted people to see some things that are on our local register, also things that are on the National Register of Historic Places, but also in conversations with the Fresno Arts Council and members of the Arts Council to say, what's something that we have downtown that most people don't know is here? And so we're trying to highlight some of our great Fresno and Central Valley artists. So people can go and see. One of the clues is find the doors that Mr. Stan Bitters designed and built. And so first people have to figure out who's Stan Bitters.
Exactly.
And then then they have to find the doors.
So well, there's a clue now.
Right. So it's very educational as well, because we know that, one of the goals is really trying to get people to spend more time downtown. And also to understand that, there's some great history
Absolutely.
There.
And if you don't go, then it's really kind of hard for you to really appreciate what's there.
It's hard to celebrate it if you don't see it and if we don't save it.
Right.
And so part of this is to our theme is really real for us. We've got to see it so that we'll know we need to save it.
So there are going to be clues for everybody.
There are clues. Teams will start with different clues. There are 33 clues around downtown. And teams have an hour and a half to get as many of the clues done as possible and bring pictures back to prove that they were there.
They have to snap the pictures to prove it. I like that.
And they can earn extra points for certain things, too. There's there's the kiss point. If you can get someone who's near the site to give you a kiss, you can earn an extra kiss, an extra point. There are others that if there are people near the site and you involve them in the photo, that's an extra point as well. And so we want to be sure that people are having fun, that we're respectful of the sites, that we honor them, and we have been in touch with the people who own the property so that we're not coming on and sending hundreds of people, hopefully, onto their property. And so it's going to be a safe, fun activity on that beautiful Saturday afternoon.
Now, what range of area are you covering in your scavenger hunt? You're going to be just over what area?
We are clearly in the downtown neighborhood. Our item that is furthest north is Divisadero Street. The one that's further south is, I believe, down near F Street.
Okay.
And so we are, and then the borders between the railroad tracks are the other borders.
Now, for people who want to participate, do you pick the team for them, or do they have their own team, or how does that work?
They can register via Facebook with the Great Historic Fresno Scavenger Hunt, and they can pay via a donate button or by check payable to the Humanics at Fresno State. By registering via Facebook, you can have your own teams. You can register singly. If you can't register by Facebook, if you don't have a Facebook page, you can contact me, 559-916-3078, and I can get you set up to pre-register. And also registration will be happening that day for an hour before the actual scavenger hunt
begins. So they can register the day
they
of as well.
Yes.
We start and stop at the Historic Warner's Theater.
Okay.
And so near the ticket booth, that's the starting line and the finish line.
And when they wrap up their hunt, what happens at that? I assume there's going to be some great activity at that point once you get everybody back.
Oh, definitely. Well, being at Warner's, we have the wonderful Historic Frank's Place, and there will be some activities and music going on there. So we will definitely be awarding prizes once the judges have come up with the winners. I imagine there will be first, second, and third place winners in teams as well as individuals. So we have a lot of great prizes. And afterwards, I think everybody will just want to celebrate, perhaps take a tour of the Warner's Theater, which the Humanics program at Fresno State has been a huge advocate for. And just mosey on around downtown. There's so many great things to see.
And this is just going to be downtown.
Yes, correct? Just downtown.
That's where your scavenger hunt is.
Our scavenger hunt
is
focused downtown.
Do you have many teams signed up as yet, or are you just now trying to get information out?
We're just getting information out. The page became open on April 2nd, and we're getting the word out. We've had a lot of interest, but I do know Fresno's kind of a last-minute town, so so I'm hoping that we'll get a lot more interest after today.
Now, you're saying this is your first historic scavenger hunt.
Right.
Do you plan to do more of these and in maybe other parts of town, or how is that going to work?
We're talking now to other organizations about what would be appropriate for other parts of town, perhaps an art scavenger hunt or a sculpture scavenger hunt, or even some of the natural resources that we have in working with some of our organizations to do a scavenger hunt for certain species of trees even.
Wow.
And so we want it to, first of all, be educational. We want it to support the organizations that our Humanics program works with. And we also want to make it a fun opportunity for people of all ages to participate in.
And in putting this together, like you said, this is your first one. What went into saying, okay, we're going to do this, and let's look at downtown Fresno first?
Right. Well, Dr. Simmons had mentioned that there's going to be the Fresno History Week, and wouldn't it be great if we could have a scavenger hunt like we did back in January? And so I kind of jumped on the bandwagon and said, well, I'll be the donations person and start getting donations, and kind of jumped ahead with it and received donations already. And so Dr. Simmons is like, well, I think this is a go. Everybody jumped on. We have our Facebook page has many, many members. And I think that it's just going to be a really great event.
It's some good news about downtown. It's something fun to do downtown what's working.
Is this part of an effort? Because, you know, there is a huge effort to really bring more people to downtown Fresno, to get them to appreciate downtown Fresno. Is this just another piece of the effort?
It's another piece of the effort. It's not that hard to love downtown Fresno. It really isn't. Right. I live close by, and I'm there frequently. It's my playground, and so we want other people to see what we have to offer there.
That's what I found. People who either live close by, who work downtown, they've had the opportunity to kind of like discover some of those treasures. And I know when I worked downtown, I was always trying to tell my friends that they should come, you know.
Absolutely.
Many are surprised. I'm always surprised at the number of people who haven't been.
Yeah, right. And having college students who came to downtown Fresno for our Humanics Retreat back in January. We had the retreat at the Warner's Theater, and we did the scavenger hunt there. It sort of was a trial run to see, you know, what clues work, what clues don't work. And Barb and other alums were with us there to participate in this, and that's when we found out this is a great way to see downtown Fresno, and it's a great way to celebrate the art and the architecture and the people of downtown.
I really like this. So people are going to be walking from...
We hope so.
Yes. Okay.
We hope so. You know, you can drive, but it's not going to help you much if you drive. You'll miss
a lot
if you do.
If you walk.
There's a lot to see.
Okay, and this is scheduled for May 11th between 5 and 7 p.m.
Right. It's there's a little walking tour in the afternoon between 1 and 4. It's a part of National Historic Preservation Week, and this is we start the scavenger hunt at 5. You can pre-register at 4.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Dr. Don Simmons and Barbara Bochum. Thank you both for coming, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Juanita,
for having us.
Well, immediately following our program today, stay tuned to FM 89 for special coverage of the Boston Marathon attacks from NPR member station WBUR in Boston. We'll also have updated coverage during Talk of the Nation and this afternoon on All Things Considered. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.